Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
You know, I'm just old enough to have grown up a little bit with the idea of the colorful drunk. And I mean the kind of drunk with three kind of Ivy League sounding names who would show up at your door in a dinner jacket and begin drunkenly quoting Catullus in the original Latin or something. People thought that was sort of a colorful person and eccentric. I'm also Irish-American. I also began my career, my first 20 years were at a daily newspaper. So you can probably imagine what my relationship with alcohol has been like. And we're going to talk today about everybody's relationship with alcohol, why we crave it, how we try to diminish its impact and influence in our lives, and what else we could drink, for God's sake, coming up on The Colin McEnroe Show.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. A lot of people struggle with sleep apnea and with CPAP machines. Dr. Carl Muller, a head and neck surgeon with Hartford Hospital, describes Inspire, a surgical alternative to the CPAP approach.
Only about 60% of patients can tolerate CPAP real well. Inspire is a surgical alternative to CPAP. It's an outpatient surgery. It takes about 2 hours. And essentially what it does is it picks up when you're taking a breath and sends a 2-second electrical pulse to the tongue, which causes the tongue to stick out a little bit and stiffen and prevent the airway from collapsing.
Hartford Hospital has performed more than 200 Inspire therapy surgeries. If you've tried and failed with CPAP, you could be a candidate for this minimally invasive procedure.
Patients with moderate to severe sleep apnea are candidates. There is a weight criteria, so you have to have a body mass index below 35, and you have to have tried and failed CPAP.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
My nectar is asleep, and the combo went back to New York. The jukebox says to take a leak, and the carpet needs a haircut, and the spotlight looks like a prison break, 'cause the telephone's out of cigarettes. The balcony is on the make, and a piano has been drinking.
You know, it's not that there's a Tom Waits song for every occasion, but there are Tom Waits songs, multiple Tom Waits songs, for occasions like this one, because we are, in fact, going to be talking about libations today. And we're going to be talking about why we like them so much, and sometimes about how we may want to renegotiate our relationship with them, with alcoholic beverages. And we have a tremendous lineup of guests. I'm really excited about the show, and it was a fun one to prepare for. And let's just say that maybe I didn't have to prepare quite as extensively as I do when I'm starting from scratch. But joining us now is the author of a really wonderful book on this subject. Edward Slingerland is the author of Drunk, How We Slipped. Sipped, danced, and stumbled our way to civilization, a professor of philosophy at the University of British Columbia. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
This is a wonderful book. And I mean, it's sort of wonderful in terms of how comprehensive it is and occasionally whimsical it is. Let me just say, if you're picking up this book and you're saying, well, I bet he doesn't know the ancient Sumerian hymn to the beer goddess, you're going to lose that bet. So let's begin with what I think is the central question of the book, which is, you know, if you look at drinking, it doesn't seem, drinking alcohol, I mean, it doesn't seem like it would be adaptive from an evolutionary standpoint. Typically, traits that are passed on for thousands and thousands of years in the human species are ones that create some kind of advantage for us. So how do we explain this mystery?
That's what motivated the book. The central question is, why do we like to drink? And the sort of immediate but shallow answer is because it makes us feel good. We like it because it's pleasurable. The deeper question, though, is why does, as you noted, evolution allow it to make us feel good? Because typically something that is as harmful as a taste for alcohol consumption is something that evolution would want to get rid of as quickly as possible. And yet humans have been producing and consuming alcohol for really as long as we've been doing anything in an organized fashion, thousands of years before we started agriculture. So at least probably 20,000 years we've been producing and consuming alcohol. That's a really long time to be engaging in what we've been told is just an evolutionary mistake. So I wanted to call into question this argument, scientific argument, that it's just kind of an accident that we like to drink alcohol, and explore the possibility that the costs that it imposes on us may be paid for by some benefits.
And mention a couple of the benefits that might be on that list.
Humans, unlike any other animal, are completely dependent on tool use, on technology, and that makes us dependent on innovation. So we're constantly, the environment changes, we have to be changing our tool sets. We're competing with other cultural groups that maybe have better tool sets than us, and we need to up our game. So we're really dependent on creativity in a way that no other species is. The problem is human infants, toddlers are quite creative. So 4-year-olds are very good at thinking outside the box, coming up with new ideas. Our ability to be flexible in that way, to engage in what cognitive scientists call lateral thinking, decreases as we age. So by the time you're an adult, you're actually not very good at thinking outside the box. You tend to get more rigid in your thinking. So one of the functions of alcohol that I explore in the book is to temporarily reverse this. So alcohol temporarily turns down a few notches the prefrontal cortex, part of our brain that's in charge of lots of great things, staying focused on task, controlling yourself, delaying gratification. These are all important things to have as an adult. They interfere, though, with creative thinking. And so one of the functions of alcohol is to turn the prefrontal cortex down a few notches. And temporarily, at least for a few hours, long enough for Tom Waits to sing a song, we think we're more like 4-year-olds again. We have a kind of flexibility that allows us to come up with new innovations. So creativity, enhanced creativity, is certainly one of those functions.
Right. So we have this notion that we also realize is a slippery slope, that alcohol and creativity go hand in hand. The list of writers in particular who have used alcohol, perhaps to their ultimate destruction, but also to their temporary advantage, is, it's pretty close to the list of famous writers. You know, you have to take Tolstoy and a few other people off of it.
Yeah.
And so there's that idea.
And Tom Waits was certainly not sober when he wrote that song.
No, and I'm also I'm also thinking, maybe most legendarily in American letters, maybe Charles Bukowski. Let's hear a little clip. This is A2 Cat. Here's a little clip from Barfly. This is Mickey Rourke, essentially as Bukowski, a character who's a placeholder for him anyway, and Alice Creed.
Why don't you stop drinking? Anybody can be a drunk.
Anybody can be a non-drunk. It takes a special talent to be a drunk. It takes endurance. Endurance is more important than truth.
I'm just going to let you react to that any way you want to.
Well, we don't. So what I argue in the book is that we actually get some of these benefits at about, they seem to really kick in at about 0.08 blood alcohol content. So that's about whatever, two glasses of wine, maybe, for your average person. So you don't need to go to Charles Bukowski levels of wild abandon to get to the place that writers and artists and even, people who are looking for creative breakthroughs in sciences, technology, those breakthroughs you can get at lower levels. So that's the slippery slope danger, is artists have traditionally, all sorts of creative types have used intoxicants to get the muse to arrive, right? You need a creative breakthrough. You can't force it. It needs to come to you. So we've used these substances as ways to allow this to happen. But because alcohol is physically quite addictive, it's right up there with cocaine and heroin in terms of how physically addictive it is. We can easily slide down the slope into what I think most people would agree is unhealthy levels of drinking. Charles Bukowski is not a poster child for how we should use alcohol in a responsible way.
No, and actually there's this wonderful quote in your book that I assume is from an ancient Greek source, although I had a little trouble unraveling that from the footnote, but it's Dionysus, the god of wine, the god of wine and drunkenness is apparently speaking, saying, "Three cups only do I propose for sensible men, one for health, the second for love and pleasure, the third for sleep. When this has been drunk up, wise guests make for home. The fourth cup is mine no longer. It belongs to hubris. The fifth to shouting. The sixth to revel. The seventh to black eyes. The eighth to summonses. The ninth to bile. The tenth to madness and people tossing the furniture about." I think we've all been in bars for all 10 of those glasses. that's the god of wine. He's still saying, sort of to your point, there's a sweet spot here, you know, yeah. And if you move beyond it, you're going to lose any benefit there ever was.
Yeah, Dionysus is a great figure, and I use him several times in the book because he is a god. He's worshipped and celebrated, but he's also feared. Mm. He's dangerous, and he can give you a gift. I love the fact that he's the one who gave Midas the gift of golden touch, right? Mm. He gives you something that seems like a gift, but then maybe it doesn't turn out so well. So you really have to be careful about him. You need to respect him and appreciate the gifts that he gives to us, but also realize that there are dangers and the dangers. And that so societies have been using alcohol for as long as, again, as we've been doing anything, but we've always been worried about alcohol for as long as we've been doing anything. You see the ancient Greeks worried about excessive consumption, the ancient Chinese, every culture that I know of uses alcohol, but also worries about it and typically institutes various types of cultural and ritual restraints or safeguards, if you want to think of it that way, to help people to use alcohol, but use it in a way where you stay at that sweet spot. You don't get into throwing furniture around.
Right. Although the sweet spot's a complicated thing, too. I mean, it giveth and it taketh away. But I think there's so many other reasons, obviously. And maybe part of the evolutionary adaptive quality is, I mean, people copulate more readily and less discriminatingly.
There's that. Yeah. Beer goggles is a real thing.
Right.
But, you know, more broadly, it helps us to socialize. So not just thinking about romantic interactions or sex. One of the other functions of alcohol is human beings are a weird primate because our basic biology is like chimpanzees. We used to live in these smaller tribes in the way our primate relatives do. And then around the time we start using alcohol, I think not coincidentally, we start living in these larger scale societies where we're having to interact with strangers all the time. We're having to trust other people. We're having to rely on other people. And alcohol also seems to be a great tool for kind of relaxing our suspicion and our worry about our inability to trust. And again, almost like getting us back to being like children again.
Yeah, let me give you
trusting of others.
Let me give you a clip for that. We got a clip for everything today. So
right,
here's the Philadelphia story. James Stewart, of course, is the journalist. Cary Grant is the aristocrat. But alcohol seems to allow them, in just the way that you're saying, to have a more frank exchange than the ones that they've been having.
C.K. Dexter Haven. Oh, C.K. Dexter Haven!
What's up?
You are.
I only hope it's worth it. Come on in.
I bring you greetings. Cinderella's slipper. Mm-hmm. It's called champagne. Champagne is a great leveler. It makes you my equal.
Well, I wouldn't quite say that.
Well, almost my equal.
So that's sort of in vino veritas too. That notion that alcohol loosens our lips up so that we can say the truth. Comment on that.
Well, that's one of the ways we use it. So if you look around the world throughout history, anytime you've got potentially hostile individuals who need to sit down and either come to an agreement or work past a point of mutual suspicion, alcohol is involved. No one starts talking until you've sat down and had a few rounds to drink. And so I actually look at the research. There's good research on this, that alcohol is a kind of truth serum. So by down-regulating the prefrontal cortex, the center of cognitive control, it makes it harder for you to lie. So lying is actually cognitively really demanding task. You've got to keep in mind what you're saying to the other person, which is not true, but also what is really the case. You have to suppress emotional reactions or facial expressions that might correspond to what's really the case instead of what you're saying is the case. It's actually really complicated and difficult to lie. And it's a prefrontal cortex type of operation. So if you can take that down a few notches, you make it harder for people to lie. You're also increasing another function of alcohol is to boost, at least in the early stages, feel-good hormones, so serotonin, endorphins. And so it's making you more expansive. It's making you like yourself more. You're more impressed with yourself. You're more clever. You're more handsome and charming. But you're also seeing other people in a more positive light. So it's also boosting kind of bonding type hormones in humans that help us to move past these potential disagreements or distrust.
So I want to get back to that thing you were talking about before, about the kind of expansive nature of it, also cognitively, that it may allow us to move. Well, you know, Thomas Kuhn in The Structure of Scientific Revolution says that, you know, we often pursue consensus for long periods of time, and then there's this big upshot, you know, this paradigm shift. And so the suggestion here is that maybe that paradigm shift happens because somebody can think in a way that isn't dictated by consensus. You're suggesting that alcohol can contribute to this. Prior to reading your book, I would not have guessed that the world of computer coding in any way could have benefited. It seems like something you'd need to get done before you had any alcohol. But tell us about the Balmer Peak.
So this is probably what started me thinking about the book. Was I was giving a talk at Google campus years and years ago about my previous trade book, which was about basically spontaneity, the power of spontaneity. Mm. I was talking a little bit about spontaneity and creativity. And in the Q&A, the first person raised their hand. They said, oh, have you heard of the Balmer Peak? So this is supposedly Steve Ballmer, former CEO of Microsoft. I think it's probably an apocryphal story, but supposedly he discovered there was this very narrow blood alcohol content level where your coding ability was just supernatural. But you needed to stay right there. If you shot past it, you got bad. If you weren't there yet, it was bad. And so supposedly he would keep himself hooked up to an alcohol IV to just hover exactly at this blood alcohol level. This is, of course, almost certainly not true. But after this talk, after the Q&A, they took me on a tour of the campus. And the first place they took me was their whiskey room. So this is this place, and it's beautiful. This amazing collection of single malt scotches and beanbag chairs. And they said that they use this in a very specific way. So if they are banging their heads against the wall, they have a problem that they can't solve, they've been, you know, drinking coffee and working on it in a very linear way for a long time, and that's not working, they change their strategy and they go to the whiskey room and start downregulating their prefrontal cortex and not trying to approach it directly and kind of force a solution, but try to let a solution come. And there's something about that gentle relaxation of cognitive control, probably combined with, you know, starting to feel good, you've got serotonin's pumping, you're relaxed, you're talking to your colleagues in a way maybe you wouldn't before, you're saying things that maybe you would think was a dumb idea, but you're a little bit buzzed now, so you don't mind saying it. That's how breakthroughs happen. And this is how people at a very successful company doing very demanding tasks move past barriers when creativity is what they need to get past it.
So, you know, the other thing that is connected to this in a positive way is a kind of sense of community. It's interesting that I think in the last 20, 25 years, there's been this vogue for the idea that the Enlightenment came about partly because of coffee houses, yeah, where you could all meet and you have a more rational discussion, and people of different social stations would sit around and talk through ideas. And then the next morning, they would remember what was said, which was different from taverns where you tended not to remember what was said. And the longer you talked, the less sense you made anyway. But there is a sense of bonding and of social ritual that we value. And we certainly idealized it on American television. It's probably the same bar that Charles Bukowski is going to. It just looks a lot nicer. Here's a little clip from Cheers.
Sammy, I didn't want to say this in front of the others, but you know what I think the most important thing in life is? It's love. You want to know what I love?
Beer, Norm?
Yeah, have a quick one. No, Sammy, I love that stool. If there's a heaven, I don't want to go there unless my stool is waiting for me. And I'll tell you what, even God better not be on it.
You wouldn't dare.
So the other thing about drinking is that it's funny. I mean, yeah, my father died of cirrhosis. I still think drinking is funny. But there's just a way in which it makes us laugh. But there's also that sense that is, I think, spelled out carefully in Cheers. We have to remember that Sam Malone, the guy who owns the bar, is in fact a reformed alcoholic. But there's this sense that this is a place where people can go and everybody knows their name and it's a kind of home. I don't know. React to that.
Robin Dunbar is an anthropologist in the UK who studies pub culture, British pub culture, and he's got a lot of survey data that shows that people who have a local, so, you know, a place like Cheers that they go to every day, have all sorts of measures of well-being that are much higher than people who don't have a local. They're happier, they're physically healthier, they're mentally healthier, they live longer. And it seems to be related to this kind of social support and feeling connected to other people that you get when you have this third space. You know, it's not mm-hmm. your home. It's not work. It's this place you go to relax and see other people and maybe have interactions or encounters that you didn't plan. You know, you just see people from the neighborhood who come in. Pubs in British culture seem to serve as this kind of glue, social glue. And this is, we've had, you know, similar types of establishments have played the same role in cultures around the world. And one of the dangerous, you know, I talk in the book about how alcohol has become more dangerous recently. One of the ways in which it's become more dangerous is it's been taken out of that kind of relaxed social environment and taken into the private home. And when we're sitting home alone drinking, it becomes a very different thing than when we're sitting at the bar, the Cheers bar, with other people.
Yeah, actually, then that may provide us with a pretty good segue into our next segment, our next conversation. We should say that Edward Slingerland is going to stay with us. We're going to add another guest. We're going to talk about how, first of all, about that whole idea, particularly during the pandemic. We drank more at home. We're still drinking more at home. And how we go about renegotiating our relationship with alcohol if we decide it's not really, we're not in the sweet spot anymore. Anyway, we'll talk to you in just a few seconds.
Lots of big money and helping white people dance. I got you in trouble in high school, but college now, that was a ball. You had some of the best times you'll never remember with me.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In-Community Speaker Series, May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speakerseries.
So if it's your first time at Dry Fridays, go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us why you're here.
Okay, I can go. I'm Jenna, and I got caught drinking a beer in my suite, and it just sucked because it was the night before my 21st birthday.
Yeah, zero tolerance policy on campus. What's up, man?
Oh, hey, I'm Kenny, and I was pouring vodka into a water bottle in the bathroom, and my RA walked in.
Ooh, busted. hi there.
Hey, I'm Courtney. Classic college story, you know. I drank 40 beers and got naked and grabbed a chainsaw, went behind North Quad and cut down like 35 pine trees. I've done it, you've done it, but of course this time I get caught, right?
All right, so on Saturday Night Live, they're even talking about renegotiating this relationship, maybe. But here in this segment, we're going to talk again to Edward Slingerland, his book, Drunk, How We Sipped, Danced, and Stumbled Our Way to Civilization. Also joining us now is Hilary Scheinbaum, a journalist and author of The Dry Challenge, How to Lose the Booze for Dry January, Sober October, and Any Other Alcohol-Free Month. Edward Slingerland, let's go back to what we were saying kind of at the beginning. You were saying that in some ways alcohol, in a very Darwinian sense, may have been able to pay for some of the damage that it causes. That's one of the ways that it has persisted as a human behavior. But the damage it causes is significant. And in your book, you talk about this. 15 million adults reported to suffer from various degrees of alcoholism, 88,000 alcohol-related deaths, an estimated cost of $249 billion to the economy. I mean, when alcohol decides to turn against us, it's not fooling around, right?
It's not. And I also point out in the book that alcohol has recently become more dangerous than it historically has been. So relatively recently, we got access to distilled liquors. So these really powerful alcoholic beverages that are just orders of magnitude stronger than the relatively weak beers and wines that we've been drinking for most of our history with alcohol as a species. So distilled liquors are one problem, but I think probably the bigger problem is what I call isolation. So historically, we've never had private access to alcohol. If you were going to drink, you drink in a public situation, usually with food. There are ritual regulations about how much you drink, how fast you drink, when you have to stop drinking. Cultures know, we talked earlier about kind of Dionysus as a two-faced god, or, you know, benefits and dangers. Cultures know this, and they build safeguards around alcohol. When we start drinking at home, when, you know, we can take a case of vodka back to our house and just access it whenever we want, the guardrails are off, and it's a completely different situation when we're drinking alone. And that's become more and more prevalent in modern life, you know, with the spread of the suburbs and market economies. So alcohol is a lot more dangerous now to us than it historically has been.
Right. And I would say the pandemic took all that and kind of squared it. I mean, people were just not out. But yeah, I love, there's one detail from your book that in ancient Greece, wine cups were deliberately shallow. So using them without spilling required significant motor control. So there's sort of a sense of how to identify this and maybe throw a lasso around it. So Hilary Scheinbaum, tell us a little bit about what's going on. There's sort of a movement now. I mean, typically the people who have been sober, the people who practice temperance, either do it for religious reasons or because they had a previous existing drinking problem, or they just don't like drinking at all, or they have a family member with a terrible drinking problem. But there hasn't really typically been a kind of, I don't know, socially approved and socially embraced temperance movement or semi-temperance movement until recently. Tell us a little bit about what's been going on.
Yeah. So as recent as, you know, 2012, this movement, you know, started in the UK called Dry January, was started by a woman named Emily Robinson, and it was basically by accident. In fact, she was training for her first half marathon and really decided that she wanted to improve her speed and, you know, get faster. So she gave up alcohol for a month, you know, being the month of January. And she realized all these amazing benefits while doing so. At the time, she was actually working for a charity in the UK that was, you know, trying to convince people to imbibe less. And the next year, they launched it into a national campaign. And the UK has been celebrating, you know, Dry January ever since. And it certainly has migrated to the US and internationally as well. So it's I don't know if that necessarily kicked things off, but there has definitely been a lot of people who are giving up alcohol for different months, different periods of time, or just deciding to imbibe less year-round for a multitude of reasons.
So you say, Hillary, that some of this is a little bit generational, too, that there's maybe a sense in which Generation Z just was going to drink less than some of its precursors.
Yeah, I think that Gen Z specifically has been consuming less. I mean, many of them are not of age quite yet either, but even millennials have a better, I think, a different approach to how they socialize. So while, you know, past generations might have gone to the bar to meet up, I think that, you know, on social media, people are connecting. There isn't a requirement for booze there. And certainly, you know, there are other activities that people are getting involved in that don't require alcohol at all. So, you know, and I think that has to do with just having more information about health and realizing every year there's, you know, newer and newer studies that show alcohol is detrimental to different parts of our bodies and our minds. So I think that is, you know, all in consideration.
You know, there's one thing that I've wondered about, and it was, we were preparing for the show, we discussed it, and I don't think we could ever pin anything down. And I don't expect that you would necessarily have this pinned down either, but you might have a kind of off-the-cuff reaction to it. I've been wondering whether the decriminalization of marijuana and the increasing, you know, access to products like gummies and stuff like that may ultimately contribute to this as well. I speak as somebody who enjoys drinking, but I also find that it just plays havoc with my sleeping, whereas a gummy kind of allows you to drift off into some kind of really pleasant place. And I'm sort of wondering, maybe some of these younger generations for whom, you know, not that everybody hasn't been smoking pot for a really long time, I get that, but there's a way in which it's a little less dangerous, a little less criminalized. I'm wondering whether that's maybe going to actually put its foot on alcohol a little bit.
You know, there's something to be said about that. And to your point, you know, when you drink too much, you obviously have a hangover the next morning. And I know that there was a study that was done in the UK that said about 2 years, I think it was, that is what the average adult spends, you know, hungover the next morning. And so that's a really long period of time. So even if it's not pot, for example, but if it's CBD gummies that are kind of taking the edge off, or other things that aren't as, you know, stirring up your morning the next morning, I think that there are definitely more options available. And certainly, you know, if they've been destigmatized, people will definitely go those avenues instead.
Yeah. And Edward, one of the things that you write about, and I think that we've all seen, there's sort of been a kind of weird normalization of the idea of wine in particular as a coping mechanism for mothers. So you start hearing about mommy juice, and there are all these T-shirts. There's wine moms and vodka aunts and stuff like that, all of which creates, I would assume, another slippery slope for women and their relationship to alcohol.
Especially if you're using it alone, if you're using it as a coping mechanism because you are stressed out because you're trying to juggle work and childcare. And, you know, typically it's the case that women are bearing more of the burden still than men in this regard. It's very tempting to turn to that chilled bottle of Chardonnay in the refrigerator at the end of the day to help you make that transition. The dangerous thing is that it's that you serve yourself from that bottle and you make as many trips back to the refrigerator as you want. In the last chapter, I look at these movements, sobriety movements that have arisen out of women who found themselves using alcohol too much to cope with using it the way people have used it always, as a transition facilitator, an easy way to get from work to relaxation mode. But doing it in isolation in a way that makes it really unhealthy.
Right. I think, you know, I was reading John Seabrook's piece in The New Yorker about giving up alcohol and then discovering now. In our third segment, we're going to talk to somebody about all the non-alcoholic, alcohol-free options that are now available in beer and wine and craft cocktails and stuff like that. But he, among mm-hmm. the things, said the thing he missed the most was the cocktail hour, which was kind of a family tradition in his WASPy family. You know, and is that transitional moment? You know, the workday is over. It's not quite time for dinner yet. Everybody's going to sit around together and have their favorite cocktail. But it is an area where you can get into trouble. So there's a way, Hillary, in which some of these months, sober October or dry January, they're kind of like circuit breakers, right? Like what would happen if you just threw the switch for a month and didn't drink? What have you found out? I know I've done it. You've done it. What are the benefits?
Oh, there are so many. And for me, it usually kicks in between week one and week two. The biggest difference for me was my sleep. So previously, when I was, you know, drinking maybe a couple times a week, having a few cocktails, I was sleeping about 5 hours a night and felt like that was my normal level of sleep and anxiety because I am a busy New Yorker and I have a lot going on and a lot of, on my mind. And simply by just giving up alcohol, I was automatically sleeping 7 to 8 hours, which historically would have never happened. So that was one major change. And that obviously impacted my mood and my energy levels. And especially in gloomy months like January, you usually don't feel too upbeat, but I was very happy. And also, you know, alcohol dehydrates you. It really can wreak havoc on your skin. And instead of having, you know, parched, dry skin, I was glowing, which, you know, for many people, you know, spending so much on cosmetics and skincare, that's just one easy way that you can really change the way that your face looks. Another big benefit too is financial, obviously, especially if you live in a big city where cocktails can be, you know, $15, et cetera, you will be seeing your bank account expand. Just by not imbibing. So those are three, but there are certainly many, many more.
You know, Edward, one of your pieces of advice, and you've said it several times on the show, and it's certainly there in the book, is don't drink alone. But there's also a way in which I've discovered this on times when I've gone on the wagon, that the people that I knew that I used to hang around with, who I used to drink with, they don't necessarily like it when you do that. I mean, you know, they kind of, some of them feel a kind of unspoken reproach. It's a complicated thing to negotiate with them, right?
Yeah, that's where, you know, maybe these new generations of mocktails and, you know, now the craft beer movement is actually getting serious about making non-alcoholic beers that taste good. So one thing you can do if you still want to mix with the same people you're mixing with and not be, you know, kind of in their face, not drinking by sipping your seltzer as they have their pints of beer, you can switch to non-alcoholic beverages that look and ideally taste like alcohol. And not only will that not make the people you're with uncomfortable or feel like you're judging them, you can actually take advantage of the placebo effect. So you'll get some of the effects of alcohol just from the cultural and historical associations you have with being in a bar, drinking something that looks like this. So that could be a way to kind of work in a circuit breaker period of sobriety without having to give up your normal social activities.
Of course, Hillary, you point out that the other way you can do it is recruit a buddy for your non-drinking period.
Yes, I surely did, although he did not last the entire month. It definitely made things easier for me for the first 2+ weeks because I had, you know, a support system and I had somebody there who was also going through the same thing that I was. But, you know, there's always other activities that you can do and take the reins and really plan for your friend group that don't involve bars or alcohol at all. So that's another point of advice that I have.
All right. Well, listen, first of all, I would be remiss if I did not say this. If you or someone you know is struggling with alcohol use disorder or other substance use disorders here in Connecticut, you can call 211 or go on the 211 website for resources. You can also call the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration's National Helpline at 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-4255. 1-800-273-4357. And, you know, don't hesitate to do that if you're getting worried about yourself or maybe about somebody else. So alcohol can be a lot of fun, but you have to have that kind of vigilance. All right. I want to thank – we're going to spend the third segment talking a little bit about some of the things that are, to Edward's point, available if you want to go in that direction. Edward Slingerland, author of Drunk, How We Sipped, Danced, and Stumbled Our Way to Civilization, and Hilary Scheinbaum. Thanks very much. I think I'll just get drunk and depressed. We are back. We are talking about alcohol. We're about to talk about the kind of the alcohol-free options. But first of all, I have to thank Lily Tyson. She is the producer of this episode and has done her usual great job. Kat Pastor is our technical producer. She's the one that's keeping the whole show humming. So thanks very much to both of you. And yeah, now we are going to talk about this. Let's say you decide that either for dry January or sober October or alternatively forever, there's always that, you're not going to drink alcohol anymore. But you do enjoy certain rituals associated with alcohol. Maybe you enjoy the taste of alcohol. You realize you're probably not going to get exactly that anywhere else. But you might want to try some things that are a little bit more exciting than, I don't know, seltzer. So here to talk to us about that is Elva Ramirez, a journalist, media consultant, and the author of Zero Proof Cocktails, 90 Non-Alcoholic Recipes for Mindful Drinking. Welcome to our conversation.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
So, yeah, for people who are sober, as the term goes now, sober curious, we are in a new era of non-alcoholic beverage options. I think, maybe sort of covered some of the reasons that that might be happening in the previous segment. But what's your take on that? Why is this happening right now?
Well, you know, it's just, the way I like to describe it is that the lyrics change, but the music sort of stays the same. So this to be American is to drink too much, and to be American is to worry about drinking. And this is this sort of tension that goes back to, honestly, before when it was the colonies, before America was America. People have always drunk too much, and they've worried that either they are drinking too much or that their neighbor is drinking too much. And how that plays out has evolved over time, but it's more or less the same. So in some ways, this is not a new phenomenon. What's new is the techniques and the attitudes towards it. But in many ways, this has been with us for a very long time. What's different now is we're benefiting from a couple different things from the culinary world. We're benefiting from the popularity of like oat milk, for example, and the vegan and gluten-free movement means that the consumer is just smarter about what they want. They want a lot of choices. And it's the same thing in cocktails. People still like cocktails. They like bars, they like the taste of it, but they don't always want to have alcohol. And now there's ways to have those experiences without having to give up the ritual of cocktails.
Right. And there are different terms for this. When I've been doing a dry January or anything like that, I often will just say to the bartender, just surprise me, no alcohol, whatever. And that can be kind of fun. And they kind of enjoy it, too. It turns out it's like nobody ever asked them to do that. So but there are different terms for this, too. And I gather mocktail is falling out of fashion. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it's, bartenders really don't like the phrase because they'll point out that mock means both fake and to make fun of. But mocktail in general just has a bad reputation, mostly because of kind of what came out in the 1980s. But just to backtrack a little bit, mocktail, according to Merriam-Webster, first appears in 1916, which is just a little bit pre-prohibition. And fast forward to the 1980s is when if you look at article databases like Factiva and news reports, mocktail as a word really surges in popularity in the 1980s because there was this movement to try to get people to, there's this epidemic of drunk driving, specifically teen drunk driving. So there were all these efforts to try to get people to not drink, and mocktail contests came out of that. But what happened was in the 1980s, people were out of touch. The craft cocktail revolution hadn't happened yet. And so people were really out of touch with the elegance of pre-prohibition and prohibition era drinks. And so what happened in the 1980s is you get a lot of like things that were like ice cream and orgeat and maple and syrup and like ginger ale for some reason. So there were these super creamy, sweet confections that no one likes. And so when people say mocktails, bartenders at least think of that. Now, I come from hospitality, so I don't like to correct people. But the analogy I make is just like there's disco and then there's dance music. Mocktail represents a specific era and time with certain production values. And so the more contemporary phrase would be zero proof, because that represents a way of looking at things using different techniques and making things differently, and also just having a more sense of cocktail history.
And so, yes, nowadays, I'm not a craft beer drinker, so I don't, but I read Seabrook's article in the New Yorker. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of new zero proof craft beers, and that may have been helped out by the fact that people drink beer here in the craft beer era a lot for taste. I don't think anybody ever really drank Budweiser because it tastes good. You know, I don't know why they drank it, but it wasn't because it tastes good. But if you're pursuing taste, taste is something that can be given back to you in a zero proof formulation. But I'm also kind of amazed by the idea that there is sort of, there's something like called zero proof tequila. How can there be zero proof tequila?
You mean in terms of just like the production, how
it's, I don't know, what is it even?
Well, you know, what's interesting, like I said, like if you think about like, the zero proof movement really owes a lot to the plant-based food people, right? All the gluten-free, oat milk, all that. So the popularity of that sector is driven by people who are moderates, who still have dairy, but then they want oat milk in their coffee. And it's the same phenomena happening in cocktails. Like I just, full disclosure, I still drink. I drink a lot less, but I still drink. And I like to, you know, switch between the two. And so that is where something like a non-alcoholic tequila or a fake gin or an alt, I call them alt spirits. That's where those come in, because that way you can still, either whether it's at home or a bar, you can still have the ritual, you can still have the taste, you can still have something that's like a gin and tonic. They tend to have less sugar and less calories because they're non-alcoholic, but they're really trying to replicate that feeling, that taste of something, really in the same way that oat milk is there to, you know, do have be a more healthy replacement for dairy, for example.
Right. So now there are, and I've read some articles about them. I am actually going to try alcohol-free wines. There are apparently some fairly good ones out there. They don't exactly taste like wine, and there are more interesting beers available than, say, O'Doul's, which was, mm-hmm. you know, the typical one of choice. And it does seem to me that this, you know, you just use the word ritual, and I think it's very hard to get away from that so many of our rituals do involve something to drink, a libation of some kind. Kat, let's play A4 here. Here's a ritual that seems to cry out for alcohol.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry to drag you from your delicious desserts. There are just one or two little things I feel I should say as best man. This is only the second time I've ever been a best man. I hope I did the job all right that time. A couple in question are at least still talking to me. unfortunately, they're not actually talking to each other. The divorce came through a couple of months ago. But I'm assured it had absolutely nothing to do with me. Apparently, Paula knew that Piers had slept with her younger sister before I mentioned it in the speech. The fact that he slept with her mother came as a surprise, but I think was incidental to the nightmare of recrimination and violence that became their two-day marriage. Anyway, enough of that. My job today is to talk about Angus, and there are no skeletons in his cupboard. Or so I thought.
So Elva Ramirez, who doesn't want to have a glass of something in their hand when Hugh Grant is giving his slightly tipsy-sounding toast, right?
Oh, my God. Well, you can still have it. I mean, the good news is that there's a lot of really great brands out there that can step in and that are meant to mimic whatever it is that you're holding in your hands. You mentioned non-alcoholic beers. Is Anheuser-Busch, among many other top beer brands, are investing heavily in non-alcoholic beers. Heineken Zero, I think it's called, or Heineken 0.1. I forget the exact name, but Heineken has a beer that when it debuted did quite well, as did Carlsberg in Germany. So big brands are paying attention to is Diageo, snapped up C-Lip, for example. And so I looked something up for you right before coming on. And according to a study I found, there's an estimated 71 non-alcoholic UK and US-based brands, and about 23 launched just last year alone. I imagine this number is actually getting a little bit higher. Even I'm having a hard time keeping up with them. And they really range the gamut. There's a lot of new spirits. There's a lot of spirits that are meant to taste like whiskey, but they're also trying to fill out that back bar. There's a brand called Liars, which is L-Y-R-E-S. And they started off with things like gin and tequila, but now they have things that are meant to taste like Campari or Aperol, Amaretto. So, you know, things are getting a lot more filled out in that back bar area. So it's, the brands are now moving past just, you know, let's have a fake gin, let's have a fake tequila, to things that are more like, I don't want to say esoteric, but they're not the first guard. We're now starting to get into things like Amaro.
So, yeah, people who work in the retail area and the distributor area of this industry say this is a growth area for them right now. It might even be the biggest growth area, adding to the shelves these zero-proof wines and beers and craft cocktails and stuff like that. Although, we're almost out of time, but I think it's worth mentioning, to go back to the mocktail thing, you know, most of the things we drink because we like the taste of them. But there's a way in which so-called adult beverages, at least your first encounter with the Campari, since you just mentioned it, nobody goes, wow, that tastes really good. I can't wait to have another one. It actually kind of, part of the whole idea of adult beverages, I think, is that they don't taste good, at least in the way that as a kid you thought things tasted good, right?
I completely agree. I did not like gin for many years. But that was because my palate wasn't ready for it. And now I absolutely adore gin and I love Campari. And it's true. I think it's just, you know, your palate evolves. I think as a grown-up, tend towards things that are more bitter and herbaceous and complex. That's not where I started. I don't know if that's where anyone really starts. There's these products that are really trying to give you complexity and sophistication so that you don't feel at any point that you're missing out.
All right. Elva Ramirez, a journalist, media consultant, and author of Zero Proof Cocktails, 90 Non-Alcoholic Recipes for Mindful Drinking. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, my God. Thank you for having me.
All right. And for the rest of you, thanks for listening today. Thanks to Lily Tyson for making this show up and Kat Pastor for executing this show. And we hope that you have a pleasant cocktail hour tonight. Just, you know, know when to say when, as they say.
From some other beginning's end.